Hello, and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. At the tender age of 11, Rob Duncan dismantled a piano in his experimental music class. This must have been a spark for him, as he is now known for recording scores on decommissioned nuclear submarines, finding his next instrument in a junkyard, or being asked by a producer to write a theme using a toilet? Though he was equally interested in computer animation, he ended up pursuing music at York University and worked writing jingles before making the jump to Los Angeles, where he landed his first breakout gig, writing the score for the final season of the cult hit Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Since then, he has firmly established himself as a go-to TV composer and has written hours of music for shows such as Castle, Timeless, and SWAT, garnering 4 Emmy nominations along the way. We chat about the importance of mentors, the responsibility a composer has for the emotion of every chord, the incredible lengths one sometimes has to go to nail a show's theme, trying to achieve work-life balance, the beauty of imperfection in sampling, and how he has managed to get through some of his biggest career ups and downs. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episode with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. Now, please enjoy my conversation with the wonderful Rob Duncan. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we spoke about, it's going on almost 4 years ago. It was the last time we chatted for the Guild AMA, right? That was 2018?
Sounds right.
So I know you've been really, really busy lately, both with projects, and I think you were moving to a new studio. Is that right?
That's correct.
How is the new studio? What's new about it? Because I remember seeing the videos of your studio back in like the early 2010s-ish. And then there was a newer studio that you had with a big white room that was almost like an Abbey Road space. So you're in a totally new space now.
In a totally new space. And currently my space is just a shell of 2x4s right now. It's completely under construction.
Right.
So I'm in a temporary studio in the house that I sort of commandeered half of my son's bedroom and built a temporary wall. That's where I'm right now. But across the hall from me are two spaces that will become a live room and a control room and also a little machine room.
Oh, cool. And this is a ground up build. You're sort of dictating and imagining everything that's going to go into this studio and really sort of making it your perfect sort of dream space?
Yeah, it's definitely downsizing from the last couple of studios, but I think, yeah, it's the culmination of I think, what my ideal space is. And actually, I think we have so much to talk about, and one of the things I know that we could probably go on for a while about is productivity.
Yeah.
You've mentioned that, you know, you like Trello, and I've heard some of your comments about scheduling and that sort of thing. One of my biggest focuses on designing this new studio is creating an environment to focus.
Right, okay.
And scaling down the number of monitors that are around me and, you know, maybe even a shelf outside for my cell phone. I don't know, whatever it takes to make this sort of a zen-like space where there's a singular focus. I go in there to write and not to, you know, surf Facebook.
Yeah, that's the bane of all of our existences. That's really interesting. So it's not just studio design. It's not just acoustic design. It's about, I'm assuming, inspiration, creative space, someplace you feel very comfortable and it is generates states of flow. But then you're also thinking about this idea of like being very focused and blocking out the outside world. I know that last time we talked, one of your biggest challenges, and I think you've mentioned this on other other interviews, is work-life balance. Right. So you said at the time when we were chatting, you're saying, you know, it's 12-hour days, 7 days a week. And that's a lot. And now you've got your studio in your home, which I think is the first, right? You haven't had a studio in the home before.
That's, my last studio was in the home.
Okay. So it was in the home. So no commute there, but then that separation still becomes difficult. So how is that journey going for you in terms of that idea of work-life balance? Is it an achievable thing? Why are you moving closer to it?
Well, having spent 8 years in a commercial facility with small kids at home, definitely felt like it wasn't for me. there are a lot of benefits to having a commercial space outside the home, but ultimately I felt that with the hours that you just described, I need, when I sort of wander out of my studio for a coffee break, I think that's valuable time that I can, you know, spend with family. And so for me, it's imperative to work out of the home.
Right. This is sort of jumping sort of right into the thick of it. How does your day get broken up? Like, where are you spending like that kind of time? Like, are you still doing those kind of long hours? And where does the bulk of that time exist for you? Like, how are you finding that being delegated out or divvied out, I should say?
I work on a daily basis from, I'm not yet somebody that writes their first note at 7 a.m. I sort of wake up comfortably and in the studio somewhere between 9 and 10. Mm-hmm. And typically take a little lunch break, take a dinner break, and back in the studio until 1 or 2. Typically speaking, I'd like to say there's a cutoff at midnight, but that's the reality at the
okay.
moment.
Yeah. And how does that break down for you? Are you sort of bulk tasking things out? Are you spending all of that time writing? Is it spent writing and then there's a chunk that's production work and then there's a chunk that's admin work? Like, how does that sort of break out? Is it consistent or is it just sort of whatever the day brings? Whatever you need to do?
It's more whatever the day brings, whatever I need to do. I mean, I definitely try to go into focus sprints. And mm-hmm. And I do try to break down the writing in terms of stages. I track all of my cues in monday.com, which okay. is a yeah. task manager. And my team and I all work on that one software app, and we break down when a cue is tempo mapped, when a cue is sketched, various drafts, notes, and so there are landmarks to the various stages of a cue's completion, and also if there's an orchestra involved, of course, orchestration, recording, and score mix notes, all that stuff is right. tracked in Monday.
Mm-hmm. And do you like? Is it? Would you say that what the reason why you have this kind of a schedule is just because of the nature of broadcast television or serialized television, that it just the turnover is so fast and there's so much that has to be done in such a short amount of time, and then you're done, that's your week, and then you just turn over a new page and start over again?
I mean I always think of a Dave Mamet quote. I probably said it in your last interview as well, but I worked on a show called The Unit where David Mamet was a writer and producer, and he commented from his perspective that creating a play was like running a marathon. Creating television is like running until you die.
I guess, that's the trick of staying alive, right?
Yeah, it's a machine. I think and don't get me wrong, especially in this day and age, I'm extraordinarily grateful to be on the receiving end of 22 episodes of television in a row.
Sure.
You know, with this Netflix show, it's 10 episodes, which even that is generous in comparison to some projects.
Sure. Do you find that in the span then of a year or a season, is there a busy period and then a period where you can actually take time off and recharge the batteries and do other things?
It's parallel to the school year.
Okay.
And when we pick up in September and we wrap up by May.
Okay.
So it's like a teacher job, I guess.
Right. And what do you do when you get those precious times to not have to be grinding away in the studio?
I was just commenting the other day that the irony seems to be when I stop working, my time is filled up, and sort of not working feels like a busier full-time job than working. I think it's because when I'm working, my focus is singular on writing. It's very it's very easy to understand the mission objective. And then when I'm released, when I wander out of that world, like Brooks from Shawshank, you know, eyes hurting from the sun, then, you know, there's 1,000 missions from home improvement and
right.
everything else.
Right. What, and this is something that's been on my mind lately is, cause I mean, nowhere near at the level that you're doing, in terms of the amount that's had to turn over, but still a considerable number of overlapping series and films so far this year. And I'm getting to the point now where I'm going, okay, I can see a limit. And the limit has to do not so much with physical burnout or exhaustion, but more of a creative burnout where you're so just nose in front of a computer screen, writing. It's output. And I'm going, okay, I'm actually going to have to do something very intentional now to fill up the creative, the creative vessel, so that I have something to draw on for the next thing. Or how do you have a structured kind of way of going about that? What kind of activities do you do? Or what do you do when you have that time? And do you actively go out and seek those things? And what are those things that you do to fill the vessel up?
It's not structured, but every time I do, I mean, my wife and I watch shows and movies, and every time I watch a show or a movie, I definitely feel that well filling up. And there was a time that I felt that watching a little clip of any movie, it could be a completely unrelated genre to the one I'm working on, but just a little taste of another universe was the cure to any hint of writer's block that I might be experiencing, or any accumulated stress over a particular project. I would find that taking a break and watching 15 minutes of a movie would switch my brain from composer to audience member, and losing myself in another cinematic world. And most often a reminder that good score doesn't have to be complicated, that it's I found that was a recurring lesson, that it's just knowing just what to add to complement what's already there. I heard a quote from Bruce Lee, of all people, that said, a natural athlete only uses the muscles necessary. And I feel like good film score is like that as well, only using the notes necessary.
Yeah.
To fulfill. And sometimes it's a journey to find those notes. And I find I may have to clear away the chaff after putting something down, but that goal is always that sort of the natural athlete approach.
Yeah. I think they call that the law of least effort, where the elegance emerges out of things where you're using the least amount of resources to say the most amount of things. Are you trying to implement that idea in other aspects of your work, in terms of like where are the areas where you see, oh, I can do this in a more efficient way? Or is there anything you've changed in your workflow over the last little while that tries to apply that law of least effort?
Yes, that's actually a big topic. on this Netflix show, I felt almost like an epiphany. I used to be scared of repetition. I used to feel that my job was to never repeat. And I missed a major aspect of the art of television scoring. I think when I first started solo work on a big show, it was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I remember hearing comments from producers about reusing cues that other composers, when they ever reused cues, that sometimes the fans would pick up on it and say, I heard a little bit of Anya's theme in the last episode. Does that mean she's coming back to life? Just compose or producers expressing certain cues having reached their shelf life. You know, let's retire this one. Let's hang this one back up.
Yeah.
And so I always felt like to do my job properly, I had to fill it with all original notes from beginning to end. And that's very, very wrong, I think, in retrospect. And it's taken me a long time to fully appreciate the value of repetition.
Mm-hmm.
So with this new Netflix show, the first cue that I wrote, the first couple of cues that I wrote for it, after I had laid down the version that I submitted, I went back and spent half an hour to an hour documenting every element of the cue in new virtual instruments.
Mm.
So that I ended up with a kit where if I needed to recreate that cue, I could do it very quickly. And then when it came time to write the next cue, I almost felt almost like a DJ kind of sensation with the motifs and the stings, and really limiting myself to one sort of type of signature swell, one type of signature hit, and really trying to maintain a connection between every piece of music.
Yeah.
Constrain it, and because we have every day thousands new options for sounds,
mm-hmm.
and they're amazing. The online resources like Splice and Loopmasters and sort of the Amazon.coms of online sounds are here. So we have infinite possibilities, and then it becomes the art of limitation, of parsing through all the available options and being purposefully minimalist about it.
I definitely understand that anxiety. I mean, because I have to consciously remind myself on almost every project I work on when I am repeating themes, motifs, and reworking things, and you know, sometimes almost verbatim. And I go, yeah, you're used to, you've seen this 1,000 times. You've heard this 1,000,000,000 times. To you, it seems like you're not working hard enough. You're not coming up with something new. But for the person that's going to watch this maybe once, you know, it maybe twice at the most, it's all going to be new to them. And they need that anchor from one thing mm-hmm. to the next to keep them carried along in the narrative flow.
Yep. Truer words never been spoken. That's so true.
So this Netflix show you're talking about is called The Night Agent. You're saying it's coming out sometime next year, hopefully. And you were mentioning before we started rolling that you've been given an opportunity here, because it's a Netflix production and not cable television, to do something a little different. And that's saying something, because, you know, going through your scores, you have a large palette. You're moving through a lot of different styles and a lot of different ways of approaching things. So I'd love to hear a bit more about what it was that you were looking and interested to do, and what your collaborators are looking for you to do.
Thank you. Well, it begins with spotting, for sure. I find that network projects, there's a more or less a predictable pattern when it comes to spotting. We always try to let dialogue and story lead and then come in after the fact for support. With this, we just hope to spot it a little differently and let scenes breathe a little more be very selective when score is needed. And then when score is needed, try to be, like I said, very specific about what we're not going to do as well as what we are going to do. I was surprised and delighted when my introduction to the director of the first two episodes, who's helping form the identity of this series, challenged me to use a desk as the percussion section for the... And I think he was, quite often when I work with producers, I get a lot of information and I realize they might not know what information is going to be useful and what information isn't going to be useful to the creative process, but they send it all anyway to see what will stick. And he was throwing out this idea could we use a desk? Would that be sort of organically spiritually connected to the story of this guy whose job is to sit in this empty room with this retro steel tankard desk?
Yep.
So I was delighted at the challenge, and because desk is actually a pretty good instrument. I mean, it's got all kinds of aspects to it. Also, depending on the number of paper clips in the drawers, as to what it sounds like.
Yeah, you can have a desk, and then you can have a prepared desk.
Yes, that's a great idea. I went around and found a hotel furniture liquidators in the valley, and they had about 60 of these desks, about 15 of them on display, and I went around checking out, you know, slamming the drawers, and when it was politely inquired, you know, what was I doing exactly, you know, I explained the concept, which in this town is, I'm not the first, you know, to
right.
To
a weirdo comes along and they're not going to put this in their house.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of sound effects, right. Editors and
sure.
Sound designers and that sort of thing in this neighborhood. But turns out this desk that I found was liquidated from an army base.
Okay.
So that felt, you know, perfect. And I brought it in and just started exploring it. It's got a very machine-like industrial sound, and it's almost a relief to curtail my explorations and say, okay, there's no timpani in this show.
You're right.
There's no taiko in this show.
Right.
You know, not allowed to use a snare drum or a gong or anything like that, but find ways to manipulate the sounds from this desk into mm-hmm. those things. And I can't say it's 100%, but it sort of fills at least the mid-range spectrum. There's still a little room for some electronic, subsonic elements and that sort of thing, but it definitely has paid dividends to accept this challenge.
Two of my favorite tools that I've discovered recently, one more recently, and one has been an old standby for sound design and sample manipulation and sample playing, is Isotope's Iris 2, and more recently this program called Grain Space, which is a granular reverb / delay unit that just creates these incredible washes of cloudy textures. Do you have any go-tos, favorite things that you sort of have, like the natural acoustic sound of you performing on a desk or an instrument of that type, and then you're going to go further, distort, warp, manipulate process? Mm.
Well, first off, as soon as we hang up, I'm checking out Grain Space.
That's so good.
But Iris, I have that falls under the category of things I thought would change my life, and then I didn't learn enough about it to get proficient in it. For me, the quick sampler in Logic is incredible to me. I've one of the greatest things about Logic is how these lightweight sample instruments are integrated as part of the compositional workflow. It's so quick and easy to throw something into a sampler and to mess with it. I do a lot of bouncing in my sessions, and then further manipulation, and then more bouncing. So I do a lot of work with audio files.
Okay.
There isn't a sort of a single sort of secret weapon. Although, of course, I am fascinated with the granular instruments that are out there.
Yeah. So this idea of using unconventional materials to create sounds, this is a journey that's been I mean, I think I heard the Wind Gong story a few times, which is an interesting inroad to why you decided to sort of really pursue this. And you can tell that story for sure. But in another interview, I read that actually at age 11, if this is true, you were asked or invited to take apart a piano as a part of an experimental music class. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
That must have been like a sort of, I have to imagine that somehow that was an initial ember of something that continued to sort of push you. Because I know I have my own sort of personal story about what led me down to the path of becoming super interested in sampling and strange instruments and non-instruments and how to incorporate those things or even make entire scores out of them. Was that a big starting point for you?
At the time, I probably didn't realize how special it was that we were being asked to explore this. I was a student at Claude Watson School for the Arts, where there was a lot of the day was dedicated to performing arts. What was funny about that piano, it was performing on the piano and almost like a prepared piano sense without much preparation, but just knocking on the soundboard, plucking the strings. And I remember not really knowing what I was doing at all. Whatever I did on my first presentation impressed the teacher enough to call the principal to hear my piece. And then he said, do it again, what you performed for me. And so I did it again, and he looked very disappointed. He said, that wasn't anything like what you played for me. I had no clue what the difference was. I must have done something right the first time and then did some, you know, whatever it was. He was very disappointed.
God, that's kind of awful.
But yeah, I think it definitely that and university was a time in my life that sort of blew the hinges off my definition of art, whether it's visual or sonic, and just being able to appreciate that really the only limitation is what you put on yourself and what you want to describe as art.
And at that time, I mean, we're sort of jumping around a bit here, but that York University experience and you saying blowing the hinges off of what you thought was what could be art, you were both interested in music and visual art at the same time, because I remember you wanted to be a computer animator originally, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So what did that mean for you? Like, I mean, when you say that that changed your perspective, was it just about like what the materials can do, where you can go with it, or was it something more about like a personal journey?
I think just my definition of music before I entered university was really narrow. It was sort of like, and my idea was art was that it existed within a frame. And then I discovered installations at York University and we had, a lot of almost ridiculous debates about what could be art and what wasn't art, and it was just really really healthy.
Right.
I took a drawing class, and somebody would drink a glass of water and put it down and say, "That's my drawing, or my piece, my performance." And you know, somebody pulled up in their car and said, "This is my project, me in my car," and then we argued about it for an hour, and it was really useful.
It's the old game of are you being an artist or are you just being a jerk? your pedigree, I guess, for lack of a better word, is very interesting. Your great grandfather arranged music for silent films in England, and apparently your relatives were affiliated with like people like Ray Vaughan Williams and Benjamin Britten. What's the connection to that, or that level of music? And did that have an effect on you growing up, knowing that this was something within your, like, it's almost, if not immediate circle, but that there was a sort of connection between those things, and this is a possible career, a thing you can do?
Well, there's another wrinkle, and that is that I was adopted, and so I'm not biologically related, but the curious part was when I was adopted, music was actually discussed with the social worker saw a musical history in my biological family, and I was placed in a home that would nurture that recurring trait biologically. In terms of my grandmother was in the London Symphony and was concertmaster for Ray Vaughan Williams' ensemble, and he was Uncle Rafe to my dad.
Wow.
And so I was very close with my grandmother, growing up, I think, they were an esteemed, very disciplined, very classical crowd. And I think that I was a kid that liked playing with synthesizers with not nearly the discipline
right.
Required to earn their respect. Growing up, I always felt quite aware of that. But there was always a piano in the house, mm-hmm. and I think that was the presence of the piano was what made me realize that it's something that I gravitated towards every day. Whereas I had, like you said, dreams of being an animator, but I realized that I just couldn't. A day never went by that I didn't do something on the piano, and I realized that it was a sort of a personal magnet or calling.
Right. There's an interesting thread in your life where it's sort of this idea of like mentorship, being able to see something and like that being made real for you and seeing a path through to that. And then a sort of an encouragement. There's a great story about a high school teacher, I think, upon hearing you do a performance for a music night, said, never stop writing music. And just sort of that kind of encouragement. Can you talk a little bit about the mentors that you had in your life? Because I know you mention those quite often. I think one of them was Lou, right? Lou Natale?
Absolutely. Yeah, Lou was my primary mentor and introduced to me from another great mentor, John Wellsman. I really felt that my time with Lou transformed me, again, sort of from a kid that liked playing with a synthesizer into somebody that was basically a trained composer. From the very beginning, I remember, the lessons. The very first lesson was about accountability for how an audience may react to something you write. When he let me have a shot at writing a cue for a scene, it was a chase scene where the good guys were chasing the bad guys and then they got away, and I presented Lou with my cue, and he said, "Oh, that all sounds great, Rob, but at the end, wrong chord."
Yeah.
And I was like, "I'm sorry, what?" He said, "Wrong chord." And I said, in my mind, I'm thinking, "Lou, this is music. There's no right or wrong, But when I asked him about it, he said, well, look, the bad guys got away, and your chord, although it sounds very filmic, has strength and victory or resolution in it, but really there's no resolution. The bad guys got away. Mm-hmm. It should be a moment of defeat, letdown." And that was my sort of film and TV music 101. You can't predict how every single person will react to the chords you write or the textures and rhythm and energy that you put into your score, but you're still on the hook for how, generally speaking, it's received.
Yep.
And if you're pressing the wrong buttons, your career won't be as long.
There's sort of a different, I don't know if you ever see those videos where it's like, quantum gravity described by like to three levels of people. Like here's to a grade schooler, here's to a middle schooler, here's to a 25-year-old, and here's an expert level. So for me, that idea, the beginning level is you have to get over your ideas and just being so into the music that you're not responding appropriately to the narrative. And then the more advanced thing, which I find super fascinating now, is I'll write something that I think is appropriate for the scene. I am being aware and responsible for that. And for some reason, there is a difference in how I interpret this music I feel it's uplifting. And another person says that is so melancholy and just down. And I'm like, that's really what you get. That is fascinating. That's so interesting that we can have a completely different emotional reaction to that.
I so know what you're talking about, and I always want to ask, so let's compare what medications we're taking. Because to me, this isn't melancholy, this is peaceful.
Yeah.
You know, so what is it? But understanding and assessing who you're working for, whether they have any musical allergies, whether they have any sensitivities, were they injured by a major chord in their childhood?
Right.
You know, and getting a... sort of a profile on them and what their expectations for score are. And for everybody, it's different.
Do you think that that might be a result of a more nuanced and advanced palate? You know, like when you're a kid and you taste Gruyere cheese, you're like, gross, disgusting. And then when you taste it as an adult, you're like, this is delicious. If you take an objective look at it, it's like, it's just gross, like moldy cheese. Like, for us as composers, we're so interested in chasing new and interesting things for ourselves, and we're developing this palette that can probably take funkier and funkier, you know, more moldy chords. And to us, it sort of changes the nuance of like whether this is actually happy or sad. I mean, that's almost too dumb. It's like we're not painting in primary colors anymore. Do you think that could be it? That when you're presenting someone, they don't have that kind of level of nuance?
The question is, does it matter? I don't know.
Yeah,
like, I wonder that, sure. There was a time, and this is a long time ago, probably 15, 20 years ago, I was working on a scene. It was a show called True Calling, and there was a... it was one of those make us cry, you know, when the spotting sessions, they say, okay, nothing to say here except make us cry, Rob. And I took it home and I really analyzed what would make me cry. And my answer was, beyond minor chord sad, major chord happy. I thought what really to pierce the beauty of this moment is to realize, for me, the saddest thing is the dream stolen, and to score a little bit of the dream that could have been, that is taken away, is to me the saddest thing. So in a way, the saddest chord for me is a major chord. That was my conclusion, and so I sort of tortured myself, bawling over this scene, thinking of all the things it could have been for this character. I handed it in and it immediately got rejected. And they said, oh, it sounds like this person is going to come back to life. So I slapped a minor chord in and they said, great.
And that's the job. Do you ever do things just for yourself in order to like get out all the funkier, weirder chords or the things that are just like so intensely Rob Duncan that they can't be put into a production because they're too specific?
I feel that there is a lot of satisfaction in working on the shows that I work on, and there isn't a pent up there isn't a lot of pent up funk.
That's great. That's a good position to be in.
This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights of film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. And now, back to our show.
Going to back just for a quick moment, because you're talking about torturing yourself or going through a pretty intense process for your great theme for the TV show Castle. You got a very specific note of what they wanted originally, and then you did an enormous amount of versioning. At a certain point, I think you sort of turned what they thought, or they sort of reconsidered what they thought. And then you had to spend an incredible amount of time working in a very different way. Can you quickly tell that story? And just what I'm curious about too is, in retrospect, would you have done anything different, or is that just sometimes the process you have to go through?
I don't think I could have done anything different. With anything, it just feels like dive in, start producing music, start letting out the ideas, and seeing where they land. I do like the approach of defining the target terms or the target words, and they were helpful in telling me they wanted swagger, this was in context. They wanted this theme was 3 bars long. It was 3 bars of music,
right?
And they wanted swagger, and I thought, well, swagger could be hip hop, swagger could be heavy metal, swagger could be all kinds of genres.
Mm.
And so there was a sort of, you know, fashion, trying on different clothes for the show, musically, that narrowed it down a little bit. But around version 6 or 7, they said, okay, we feel that you've done a good job at exploring swagger. Now I think we realize we don't want swagger.
Right.
Again, it gets semantic, and what is it exactly that they're hoping for? In the end, and what sort of saved me was the producers were very calculated and thoughtful about what they were looking for musically, and at the end, I had produced enough themes and ideas and motifs for the show that they sort of answered it for me and said, bar 1 theme A, bar 2 theme B, bar 3 theme C, and it made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. But when people ever ask about writer's block, usually I if I've slept, if I've eaten, if I'm fairly, you know, in a sort of generally in having a normal day, there's not really writer's block. But on version 12 of this theme, when their latest instructions were sit down at the piano and just write those 3 bars on the piano, I spent the entire day trying to compose 3 bars on the piano and felt, yeah, at the end of the day that I had nothing. And that was my my strongest recollection of feeling blocked.
Right.
Was those 3 bars.
How do you, you know, I mean, there's, so this idea that you get to version 6 or 7 and they say, you know what, you've done the job we asked you to do, and we realize this is a non-starter. So even though it's not a failure, but it doesn't feel like a win either. You've done your job. You've taught them something. You realize something valuable, but you also haven't won. Now you're grinding away on, you know, several more versions, and now you're moving completely in a different direction again. Like in those moments now, when you have those kind of times, how do you sort of manage the feeling of like, Is this me? Is this them? Is this worth pursuing? When do I call this, either for myself or when I say, no, this is beyond, I don't think this is going to work out for either of us. Maybe I'm not the right guy for this. How do you manage that whole thought process?
Good question. I feel that there's a funny balance in writing music that's somewhere between getting out of your own way and not letting go of yourself at the same time, because I do feel like we let our, you know, inner critic, you know, shoot down great ideas too often, and you just need to open the taps and liberate yourself to write a lot of crappy music if necessary, to just get the pipes flowing. But then at the same time, there's a special section of hell when you've completely detached from your own taste and sensibilities and are simply trying to find that magic combination that will get them to stop harassing you over this cue.
Right.
And I feel that that's very dangerous too, because you have to ultimately, at the end of the day, believe in what you're handing in. Mm-hmm. And I think of our job as sort of like a hairdresser. My old favorite hairdresser, who is Toronto based, every time you sat in his chair, he made you feel like you were getting the world's greatest haircut. he would compliment himself every chance he got, like, "Oh, you look so good. Oh, damn, I'm good." And he was, and I think that if I walked out of his salon just feeling like $1 million every time, and I think that we're sort of styling a show like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we are a fashion consultant for content, and some people may come at us with bizarre requests, but if I went to my old hairdresser and said, "I want to put two tails in the front of my head and shave the back," he would put his hands on my shoulder and say, "You want to look cool. I understand. I got this. Trust
yeah.
me."
Yeah.
You know, and he's not going to verbatim do what I'm requesting. And speaking of the Castle producers, after waxing on about giving me all the information they could think of about the motivations and aspirations of a particular scene, they would often end it by saying, "And by the way, don't give us what we're asking for. Give us what we need."
Ooh. Wow. That's amazing.
I always appreciated that. Although it's another way of saying, if you screw this up, it's on you.
Yeah, that's true. But I suppose it's like, don't be afraid to try what you think is the right direction, even if it's bumping against what we're saying. But of course, you have to provide both options for review afterwards. It's not like you can just do the one and not the other.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. I really like that hairdresser analogy, because I think one of the... You know, not to put this in a sort of non-creative, non-artistic sort of businessy kind of perspective, but there is something about this idea of really great companies make you feel amazing about the product that you've just chosen to buy. There's a whole process after you've made the purchase where there's a follow-up, and it says, "First of all, congratulations and thank you for your purchase. We know you're going to love this. You've made a great decision." And I think that hairdresser analogy, as he's complimenting himself and saying, "Oh my God, you look so great. I'm so amazing." I mean, we couldn't do this with our producers. They'd be like, "Who the fuck is this guy?" But I think this idea of making your collaborators feel amazing about the process and that what you are doing together is so great, that's a really valuable tip.
I would say that one of the big times that this comes into play is when they give you a note that seems like it came out of left field. And I've been humbled enough times by what I thought was a crazy note. And then when I actually bring myself to try it, I think it wasn't actually so crazy. It actually kind of works. And then I feel a bit dumb. Like, why did I dismiss this? And then I find that... when they give a note that seems out of left field, I take it as a challenge. There's problem solving challenges. We do 1,000 a day, little decisions that are problem solving. But if we take the strange note, we make it brilliant. We give it back to them and give them credit for that direction. I didn't hear what you were saying at first, but when I got back into the studio and I tried recording that can opener, or whatever it was, I'm actually quite excited about what happened. So check it out and to try to make them feel great about their participation.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all notes are desire, nervous energy. To participate and okay, you gave us this. Can you give me something better? Do you have anything else in the tank that's maybe better than this? You know,
yeah, that's a great point. I love that. Winding back a bit to where we left off with Lou and mentorship. You said in other interviews that sort of gave you that perspective. You saw what was possible, And that was what sort of enabled you to sort of make that big jump. And that big jump was to Los Angeles, about 5 years after working with those mentors. So, and then I'm hoping you can sort of fill in the blanks, because what it's a lot of times it's sort of skipped over, because it's like, I got to LA, I did a few things, you know, worked these jobs, then I landed Buffy. And it's just like, how did that happen? What was the process from getting like, hey, everyone, I'm new in LA, you know, I'm the only composer here, so I know I'm going to get tons of work. you know, how did that process happen?
Right. Well, and on that topic, I also there was something that you had asked me in over an email that prompted me to talk about or to think about schmoozing. I never felt like I was a natural schmoozer. I almost felt like I missed a class on that. But in retrospect, I'm glad to report that somebody like me, who isn't necessarily natural at working a room, can still have a career.
Mm.
Because it's not the most important thing. The most important thing, I think, when people are looking to hire a composer, I think they go through the same process that we go through when we decide to hire an engineer. We are looking for somebody that will hear the vision that we've started, will take the ball from us and move it closer to the goalposts with as little explanation and work as possible. Mm-hmm. If I feel like, okay, I enjoy working with you, you understand what I'm going for, even if I can't find the exact words to express it, and you know this field and you'll take it down the road for me, and closer to my goal. The other thing is, again, with hiring an engineer, I find myself looking for other clues as to what adds up to my sense of their perceived value, and that's the projects that they've worked on, who I know that's worked with them, and referrals. And referrals have been key for me in getting work as well. Referrals were key for me in getting my agent, and because quite often the front door has a huge daunting lock on it, and you can knock on it like everyone else and maybe they'll open it a crack and you'll be able to say your spiel, but really the power of somebody else saying, hey, I know this guy, I know you're going to hear his music, he's a cool guy, if you want to, you know, I've worked with him on this project, and I think you'll like him. If you like his stuff, give him or her a shot. And at key moments in my career with the agency and with some of these jobs, it's been I've noticed this pattern of people vouching for me at key levels. And in fact, that was one of the valuable functions of an agent, was not even necessarily getting the work, but just to say, hey, he's with us, or you know, she's with us.
Right.
You know, to be honest, nobody's ever asked me, where did I go to school?
Yeah.
In 25 years doing this, nobody seems to care. Whereas other occupations, it might matter. You know, it's first on your resume. You know, but I feel it's sort of replaced by other things that would communicate a sense of value, and being affiliated with a certain agency may help, you know, get you through the door. If you know, on Buffy, for example, there was a moment where the head of music at Fox said, "Who the hell is Rob Duncan? Why should we be thinking about him?"
Yeah.
And Gorfain Schwartz said, "It's okay. We know this guy."
Right.
You know, and she's like, "Okay, I'll listen to his stuff." And quite often it's just almost random connections. There was a show that I was working on getting, and I discovered that a film director that I knew, that I played video games with, had directed a short film that was written by the showrunner of the series that I was hoping to get, and was at the level of comfort that he didn't mind saying, "My buddy Rob is up for your show. Check his stuff out. Right. He's a nice guy. Whatever. That's all it sort of." When those started adding up, then the buzz started forming and the perceived value started being established.
What was the thing that got you in the door with Gorfain? And like, what did those early years in LA look like? Was it really tough? Did you have moments where you thought, "Oh, this is never going to work"?
Well, again, a shout out to Lou. I continued working for Lou from Los Angeles. I will never forget that the FedEx office was when I had to race down Wilshire Boulevard to the FedEx office. The international overnight cutoff was at the time when the sun was blinding me as I drive. I'll never forget that repeated scenario. But he allowed me to continue assisting him and working with him, despite me being in Los Angeles, and that allowed me to pay my bills and keep me afloat. So a lot of gratitude towards Lou for despite defecting south of the border, he was still supportive.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he was proud of you and rooting for you to succeed as well. Sort of on the same topic as this idea of, how you say you're getting work and the idea of networking and schmoozing and not necessarily being a person who works the room, et cetera. What's been your experience with, finding new work and the whole process of, like, while you're so busy doing the work, what's the method of feeding that hopper or continuing to get new work? And the reason I ask is there was sort of this really great slew of videos. I think you had like a PR company maybe working for you sort of in the 2010s that produced this really great series of videos where you're like doing a studio tour. They're joking about you being a music or instrument hoarder. You're showing off all your instruments. You're doing this great, like, let's go to the junkyard with Rob and see all the crazy things he finds to make sounds with. And then you're doing a lot of things. You're on Pensado's place. You're getting all these interviews and podcasts. And it seemed like there was a little sort of blip there where you're really putting a lot of focus on that kind of activity. Did you feel that had a good sort of return on investment? Is that something that you would continue to do? What was that whole process? Like, how did you think about this idea of marketing and getting more work in not the referral way?
Well, first on the topic of getting work, I feel that the most important aspect of my career are return customers. Mm. And the majority of my work that I do is for people that I've worked for before. Everybody has a guy or a girl that does their scores, and I feel when three producers converge on a project, they all say, "Well, I've got my guy or girl," and give them a shot at this, and then it's sort of like a bit of a process as to how they decide who, and sometimes it's an audition, so nurturing those relationships, I think, are a key. And then refresh my memory on the other aspect of the
question. Well, just this idea of like putting out marketing materials, right? Because you had these great videos and you were sort of doing a lot of interviews and stuff. And I wondered what you felt in retrospect about that those activities and what you would do now, if anything.
Right. Thanks. The PR, the concept of a PR agency is interesting because as I was doing it, I wasn't quite sure as a composer, we could put out material for the public, but the public isn't hiring us.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting, interesting experiment. I felt like the PR agency helped me get out of my own way a little bit. Like I might not have released a video because I didn't think I felt like I looked too tired after an all-nighter or something. And they're like, it's fine. Just get it out there. Come on. We got to get this out by Monday. And they would just set up a constant flow of interviews and exposure. And I do think that as one fellow composer once said to me, it's important to make sure your stock is rising. And I think that... the PR company helped do that. Whether or not I wouldn't say it necessarily landed me another show or series, but I think it did in an overall sense help sort of boost my stock price, so to speak.
Right. Was there a social media component to that? And what's your relationship with social media now?
I'm a little quiet on social media.
Right.
And that's a tricky one because it's a hard one to delegate to somebody else.
Yep. So, speak in my voice and make me look good.
Yeah. I'm not super active on social media.
Well, the cool thing about those videos, and I think this sort of goes, because I'm sort of a semi student of this kind of stuff, like how to market yourself and all these kinds of things. One thing that's really cool about them is they're kind of evergreen, right? You look back at them, and even though they're almost 10 years old now, they still have a relevance and a kind of spark because they're really fun, genuine. They really show who you are as a person. They're not like a tweet that went away or some little thing. They're like this whole thing that even now they come up in a search, and everyone kind of that you talk to, they get really excited about this really cool little adventure they went on with you.
So I have to add to my story about the desk when I was at the hotel, when I was held at the hotel Liquidators auditioning desks. The salesperson got quite excited about this whole adventure of finding a desk that was the most musical in the bunch.
And, Steinway of desks.
Because he was a musician and he was there for it. We were having a great conversation, and as I was pulling out of the parking lot, he ran out, like after I'd said goodbye, he ran out and said, "Dude, you were on Pensado's Place? You're a legend."
That's awesome.
So, like you say, it does have that. That's a nice, a nice thing.
It is legendary to be on Pensado's Place. I think that's probably a high watermark for a lot of people to get on with Dave and those guys and Herb. I was wondering if we could sort of switch gears a little bit from the positive. Well, I'm hoping that this is ultimately positive, and you can tell me if this is a non-starter or not. But I find it really interesting to hear from people about, you know, a tough time or something that happened to them that was a huge disappointment to them. They thought something was going to turn out a certain way, or just, you know, and sometimes it's a failure, a personal failure, maybe not working up to a level that you thought you could or whatever else. And sometimes you mistake what you think is a failure is actually just a disappointment or something that was beyond your control. I wonder if you have any stories or anything you can relate to everyone about that. How you thought about it, how you worked through it at the time, and how you think about it now.
Well, absolutely. I would say philosophy on that is absolutely critical to having a career as a freelance creative person. And I think it starts long before we write professionally. My initial answer is I try to erase the failures from my mind
right.
and make space for the victories. One thing that I felt was absolutely critical was to create a mental victory scrapbook. And on the early pages of my personal victory scrapbook was that music teacher that because I felt like a lot of music teachers felt I was just a sort of skateboarding slacker and was a sort of a C student, sort of not worth paying much attention to, which I don't fault anybody for. But there was this one teacher that saw beyond that and saw somebody that had something to offer in music and said those comments to me. And that got printed in my victory scrapbook, because you'll see nine out of 10 people won't have the vision to see what you may have to offer. They'll judge you on what you've done and not necessarily what you could do. And we see ourselves as what we could do. And those special people that come along and show you that they see what your potential is, and those moments when you win an award or get selected for a project, I think it's a necessity for survival to put those in a mental scrapbook. So during the other times when it's just rejection after rejection, you can just turn the page and remind yourself about these other moments and let that fill your tank a little bit. Certainly there's no end to the rejection. I mean, even as a student submitting songs for a songwriting contest, I was so sure, okay, I'm going to win this, and quickly you learn that, okay, you do your best, you hit send, you hit launch, and then let it go and try to forget about it. And maybe you'll get a wonderful surprise, or maybe it'll just be like most of the launches and just disappear into space. It's very hard, I think, when you invest a lot of time and in some cases in my life, a lot of money. Like I've used orchestra for some pitches at times that have just fizzled out and gone nowhere. And I just think, wow, I just spent thousands of dollars to impress somebody and they won't even return my call.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah.
But I really feel that there's no real value in hanging on to that. But just get out there and maybe don't spend thousands of dollars next time, but don't dwell on it and don't let it make you bitter. Leave space for the next victory in your head.
Yeah. One thing I really like, cause I don't remember where I heard or read that, that quote from you, that mental scrapbook idea, which I really like. I actually have a physical, every year I keep sort of a list of wins, you know, just things that were really great experiences, travel opportunities, you know, recording opportunities, all that kind of stuff. Great gigs that happened. But what I loved about the way that you said it when I read it or heard it was that you said you're making note of those moments where things that you did moved someone. And I thought that was a really nice perspective on it. It's not about achievement or, you know, being great as a composer or anything. It's about, like, I had an effect. Like, there was an emotional connection that's about something bigger than just ourselves, which I think that's that could be looked over very easily, that's sort of like the key element of it. And I think that's really important that we remember as creative artists that we're in a human world, and that's really, when it comes down to it, the most important thing is that we're connecting with people. And I think when we're making things, whether it's, you know, a short or a web series or even a broadcast television, you know, series, that's what we're trying to do with a bunch of other people.
There's a quote that I can't attempt to say verbatim, but it's from, I believe it's from Andy Warhol. It just is, in essence, keep making art. Don't listen to critics. Don't work, don't involve yourself in the people arguing about whether what you did is worthwhile. Just spend that time making your next piece.
Yeah.
I feel like you, on the internet especially, you'll have somebody criticizing you before you open your mouth, and if you dwell on any of that negativity, it'll just bog you down.
Any what's sort of been on your mind lately in terms of like interesting finds or neat pieces of art or maybe a music or a film or a series that you've been watching or anything that sort of like sparked your imagination lately?
There's so much. I love a lot of what I hear on television. I'm constantly impressed with what people are doing on series, and slightly worried about how much time and energy must go into some of the TV productions that I see.
In terms of the music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. TV is being treated to some excellent scores these days.
It's true, yeah.
At the top of the list for me is probably The White Lotus. It's not exactly new, but I love that score. And also, a lesson in repetition, effective repetition. Definitely, you sort of itch to hear some of the aspects of that score and enjoy it. You get a little hit when it comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's doing fantastic work, Tapio Devere, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, just to sort of give you a compliment back on that same realm as this idea of worried about how much time is going into these things. I mean, that's what I feel listening to, you know, your work on things like The Last Resort, Timeless, and Spark, by the way, which is just gorgeous. It's an animated feature, right? And you did it at Abbey Road with the LSO or... It's just gorgeous, and it's kind of funny because that's 2016, right? Like the Spark, somewhere around there. We spoke in 2018, and I asked you like, what's your sort of like goal, like your big thing? Well, you know, How to Train Your Dragon is Star Wars. I think you're in that ballpark, man. Like you could easily be doing the next thing. Like the stuff on Spark is just gorgeous, like really. Really beautiful work. As with all your work, I'm always very impressed. As I think I told you last time we chatted, it never sounds like it's TV music. It always sounds like very big, cinematic, wide, and like there was a lot of love put into it, a lot of time, a lot of energy, and obviously talent.
Thank you. And you know, some advice that was given to me once across a dinner table for a composer who's sort of a composer hero. And he'd asked what I was working on, and I explained, well, I just sort of came out of my cave. The last 4 months I spent working on this indie film, and we thought it was going to go to the theaters, and it ended up just fizzling out and going to DVD. But I spent X amount of money from my own pocket beyond what I was paid to make this thing be a calling card. And he looked at me square in the eyes and said, make sure every single person in Hollywood hears this score. Like, just basically reminding me that this is part of our job. And honestly, I don't feel like I fulfilled that advice as I should have, because it's in a way, it's not my strength. And yeah. And I think that's where somebody who's helping toot your horn in the PR department is invaluable, because I sort of poured my heart and soul, made untold personal sacrifices in terms of family time and into this project, and then just let it get buried, you know, in history. And whereas a PR agent would basically say, Let's get a list of all the people that need to hear this and start sending it out and start working it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the toughest things, I think, is to have the audacity really to say, I'm worth it. People are going to take the time and listen to this, and they're not going to feel like I'm wasting their time. Like you're actually adding value. You know, that's a super big challenge. You know, I even find that with people who write their own material just for them. Well, not for themselves, but they're doing their own uncommissioned work. And then they go out and they say, come to my show, listen to my music, buy my album. And I'm incredibly impressed by that, because I find that incredibly hard to do, to ask someone to take the time if especially if it's my own work, to say, hey, check out my stuff.
You know, my high school girlfriend hammered it into me very, very correctly after years of me saying, want to hear my new song? Want to hear my new piece? And she said, Rob, when somebody listens to your music, they are giving you something. You are not giving them something. They are giving you something. And it stuck with me all these years. And in some ways, it may get in the way sometimes of the promotional stuff. But really, it's true. When somebody gives you their time and attention, it's a gift from them.
Yeah. Well, Rob, thanks so much for taking the time. This has been really fun and super interesting to get the behind-the-scenes stories on some of this stuff and how you're continuing with your strange musical instruments journey and finding things in odd places to turn into beautiful music. And as always, you know, it's just really a tremendous pleasure to listen to all your work. And, you know, it's getting out there. I mean, regardless of if you didn't send that work out, it's getting around. I think you're only headed upwards, and it's really exciting to watch your journey.
Thank you, Adrian. It's always a great pleasure to chat with you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes and tagging us at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. The Screen Composers Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Editing, graphics, audio, and video post-production by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as the SOCAN Foundation for financial support.